So why are we talking about Andy Warhol at a baseball conference? Well, part of it is Andy Warhol, we're in his hood. He grew up just south of Forbes Field, so close that his immigrant father would bag peanuts to take up to the stadium and sell them there to make extra money. What's the Andy Warhol triple play? It's the name I've given to three paintings that Andy Warhol has done of baseball players. One of it all captured during high points in their career, or important points in their career. Roger Maris, right after he broke the home run record. In 1985, he captured Pete Rose as he was approaching Ty Cobb's all-time hit record. And Tom Seaver, at a critical juncture in Tom Seaver's career in 1977. Our leadoff hitter today, Roger Maris. The painting was done in 1962. This was at the very beginning of Andy Warhol's career as an independent artist. In July of that year, he sold his first tomato soup can painting that you might be familiar with. That soup can sold for $100. The Roger Maris painting is the only one of our three paintings today that is not named for the player. It is actually named baseball. We'll get to why that is in a minute. Every one of the paintings, and all paintings, really have a third critical member that's involved with the painting, and that's either the gallery owner or the art dealer or the art collector. In this case, it was Eleanor Ward. Eleanor Ward's position in the art world cannot be overstated. She was responsible for either discovering or furthering the careers of several artists that you might know, including Jasper Johns, Jackson Pollock, Robert Indiana, who we see here with her. He died just last month. She was also instrumental in Andy Warhol's career. In November of 1962, Eleanor Ward gave Andy Warhol his first solo exhibition in New York City. In that exhibition, one of the paintings that sold was the painting called Baseball. Baseball sold for $1,800. On the next slide, I'm going to show you that painting. I'm going to give you a couple seconds to digest it. So we're going to imagine we're in an art gallery looking at this painting. Ladies and gentlemen, Andy Warhol's Baseball. This probably looks a little atypical of Warhol's work if you just know Warhol in general. At its simplest, it is a black and white ink silk screen on white canvas. And you can see why Andy tailored baseball. He's not capturing a single player here. It's not just Roger Maris by himself. And that's even up for debate whether or not it's Roger Maris. He's trying to capture the action and activity of the game. And he does it through repeated imagery. Despite this not being... this not being typical of Andy Warhol's style, it does contain three pieces of Andy Warhol's principal styles. One is it is a seriograph, a repetition of several photos, or repetition of the same photos several times. Secondly, it's a silkscreen, the technique he'd be known for the rest of his career. And thirdly, it uses appropriation. In this case, he's appropriating a photo. I mentioned in the last slide that this is a silkscreen. More specifically, it's what Andy Warhol called a photo silkscreen. What is that? It's the silkscreen of a photo. Prior to 1962, he had done silkscreens, but only from drawings. This is the first time he did it from a photograph, and he mentioned this in a 1981 interview. He says, that's how it all started. The baseball painting was the first to use photo silkscreen. This is monumental. This is the first time anybody does anything is very important, and for Andy Warhol, it would change his career. This is as important as Candy Cummings discovering the curveball in the 1800s. And to further illustrate how important it is, the $1,800 painting that Andy Warhol sells in 1962, he uses the same technique. He takes a single silkscreen, a single image, makes a silkscreen of it, repeats it three times. You have Triple Elvis, 1963, a couple years ago, sells for $80 million. That same technique is based off a painting of a baseball, called Baseball. part two of our triple play, we have the polarizing figure of Pete Rose. And now I move forward to 1985. I've done these out of sequence to show you the art more than the chronology. So 1985, Andy Warhol, he's on the other end of his career. He spends as much time being a celebrity as he is an artist. He has produced record albums and movies. He's doing books. He's written magazines. And he's also a host of a talk show on MTV. The story of the Pete Rose painting starts with a self-taught art dealer named Carl Solway from Cincinnati. He's driving home, listening to a Cincinnati Reds game on the radio in 1985. Joe Nuxall comes on and he says, later this year, Pete Rose is going to break Ty Cobb's record, probably in September. Carl Solway thinks to himself, hey, wouldn't it be cool if the art community could get involved in this? And just instead of just all the jocks and the sports people. And he gets involved with the Cincinnati Art Museum. And they say, yeah, we think this is a great idea, too. Why don't you talk to Andy Warhol and see if he can do it? Solway talks to Warhol, and Warhol says, okay, I got a couple of things for you. It's going to cost $100,000. That's what a commission of this type costs. Okay, we can deal with that. And he's like, you have to get the permission of the subject, Pete Rose. Okay, and then Andy Warhol has one question. Who is Pete Rose? For what it's worth, this obliviousness does run both ways. Later that summer, Pete Rose is asked about Andy Warhol and the painting. First thing he mentions, it's about the money, and he ain't getting none. Pete Rose is Pete Rose. He's not getting any royalties, etc. And then he goes on to say, this Warshaw guy, what is his name? Yeah, Warhol. Oh yeah, I think he's a respected artist. I heard he did Muhammad Ali. So, thank you, Muhammad Ali. We do have this Pete Rose painting, which will be coming up next. This painting is on display at the Cincinnati Art Museum to this day. Here we can see 20 years of difference in Andy Warhol. Significantly different, like when you first look at it. Number one, you can tell right away we've got Pete Rose here. And number two, the color. You know, we're not dealing with a black and white painting anymore. Whenever Andy Warhol did the Maris painting, you know, he was just starting out with his photo silkscreen. Now he's moved up to color. However, we see a lot of the same techniques. Number one, we see the repetition. So we have another seriograph. Yeah, it's not dozens of images. It is only four, but it's still a seriograph. And number two, it contains appropriation. Number one, the photo. It's based off a photo by Cincinnati photographer Gordon Baer. And number two is also the design it's taken, which is from a 1985 Topps design. Warhol kept a lot of the baseball card design. However, he changed the dimensions. If you can see here, the baseball card is slimmer than the Pete Rose version. Andy Warhol preferred to work in the more square format of a canvas, and I believe that's why he decided to make the individual images of Pete Rose larger. To give you an idea of the size of the painting, here it is with Carl Solway and some of his associates in front of it. Its overall size is 9 by 7 feet, composed of the four smaller panels. How does the Cincinnati Art Museum finance a $100,000 commission? Quite a bit of money in 1985. It's quite a bit of money today. What they do as part of it is they get Andy Warhol to make signed lithographs. The signed lithograph is a lavender painting that's side by side with the four up painting. And they sold those to the patrons of the museum for $2,500 a piece. They sell 50 of these, that would pay for their $100,000 commission. If they sell them all, they sold all 50 paintings. The Cincinnati Art Museum made a profit on the commission. One of these came up on Antique Roadshow a couple years ago. The estimator recommended it be insured for $30,000. Carl Solway, the man who originally worked on creating this commission, very happy with what happened. This is a great quote about him talking about it. The idea was completely Warhol's idea. He was a brilliant. Since baseball cards are collected and traded just like artworks are similarly collected and traded. It's a clever comment by Warhol of the art market and the commercialization of it. And this is interesting because remember when we started this chapter, we talked about how Andy Warhol wanted to, or how Carl Soloway wanted to connect the art world with the sports world. Andy Warhol did it. Now, whether Carl Soloway told Andy that, I don't know. But he did. He said, hey, both these people are collectors. You collect art. There's some people out there that have to collect baseball memorabilia. And really, when you think about it, baseball cards are little tiny works of art. Our last chapter is dedicated to somebody that did get into the Hall of Fame, Tom Seaver. We are going back in time to 1977. This is the middle of Andy Warhol's career. And it's, to me, it's the height of his career. He's doing a lot of portraiture at the time. He's heavily involved with Interview Magazine, and he's just come out with a book called The Philosophy of Andy Warhol. The collector that starts the Tom Seaver story is a man by the name of Richard Weissman. He's an art collector, art dealer, and he's also sort of an investment banker. He comes from a little bit of money. His mother was instrumental with the founding of MoCA in the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. So he's a, and he has this idea of creating a series of, having Andy Warhol create a series of portraits, 10 of them, of athletes. For that, he pays Warhol $1 million. Of course, Andy agrees to this idea that, in the words of Sabre's own Tom Seaver, Andy Warhol does not know the difference between first base and a first down. So he tells Richard Weissman, you've got to pick out the athletes that are going to be part of the series. The number one athlete he picks out is Tom Seaver. There's a couple reasons why he does this. Number one, he knows Tom Seaver, and he knows the type of person Tom Seaver is. Tom Seaver's brother, whose photo here with his hands there, that's Charles Seaver. He's a sculptor. And also Charles's wife, Juliet, on the other side, happens to be a painter. They are both artists. This is taken in the East Village, an artist community at the time. And so Tom Seaver's familiar with art, and he is comfortable around artists. And Richard Weissman's like, okay, I got somebody that can deal with Andy Warhol. And then the second reason is he's got Andy Warhol. He plays for the New York Mets. Terrific. I can get him down to the studio anytime I want. Except what happens on June 15th, 1977, the Midnight Massacre. So all of a sudden, Richard Weissman has the same problem as Carl Soloway. It's unbelievable. He's got an athlete in Cincinnati. He's got an artist in New York. What's he going to do? Tom Seaver returns to New York. The very first day he's back in New York is for the 1977 All-Star Game, Yankee Stadium. Who gets the biggest ovation? Not Thurman Munson, not Reggie Jackson. Tom Terrific. Great moment in that game. And the very next day, so this is July 19th, the very next day, and he's in Andy Warhol's studio. So Andy Warhol's portrait of Tom Seaver is made his very first return trip to New York, where he had a bitter, ending there with the Mets. And we're very fortunate. We have a fine art photographer, Rene Perez, back in 1977, was working as a stringer in New York, and he took photos of this session where Tom Seaver and Andy Warhol meet. This is a great picture. Two icons, absolutely awesome. And so we can take a look at what Warhol did that day with Tom. This first picture, the second picture, I love because it shows the instruments that work with Andy Warhol. This is called a Big Shot Polaroid camera that he's using there. Very funky looking camera if you're not familiar with them. Completely back from the old days when you had that little square flash bulb that flipped around. There's a couple of reasons why Andy preferred this camera. Number one, he liked the photos it took. As an artist, you need that, and that's great for him to capture it. And two, I think he enjoyed the intimacy it gave him with his subject. Notice how close he has to be to take a picture. If you're familiar with the old Polaroid cameras, to take a good picture of a person, you did have to be close to them. And then a third thing that he liked about him, this is in the age before digital photography, it's 1977. He has instant feedback. This way he can go up to Tom, he's like, do you like this picture, do you hate this one, etc., and they can decide a little bit of how they feel about the different pictures. It's Incidentally, Tom Seaver, look at him wearing the cap on backwards here. He's styling. I think Ken Griffey got it. Junior got it from him. These Polaroids here, one of those was used to make the painting of Tom Seaver, which we will see next. So the Polaroid is basically used to develop the stencil, basically the black portions of this. They're Tom Seaver's face and facial features. And then the color is painted in either prior to the stencil going down or after. And what happens when Weissman bought this for $1 million, he actually gets 8 prints. All the stencils are basically the same, but the flares, the different colors like the red on Tom's collar or the green above his eyes, would be vary from painting to painting. And that's how you get the 8 different flavors. Tom Seaver got one, Andy Warhol got one, and then the other 6 went to Weissman to sell. This is the specific Polaroid that they came from. Notice that Andy Warhol brought in the picture a little bit tighter. And the other thing I've noticed when I'm looking at this is I believe the irises and his eyeball pupils are brought more centered in his eyes. And I think that's an artist's technique to get you more centered in the frame. What did Andy Warhol think about this session? It's amazing. Andy Warhol has these very detailed diaries and tells you all kinds of interesting things. And this is from July 20th, 1977, day after the All-Star Game. Andy Warhol absolutely loved Tom Seaver. Tom Seaver was adorable. Athletes really do have the fat in the right places, and they're young in the right places. Here's a couple of the other paintings involved in the athlete series. Notice Muhammad Ali, our star from the Pete Rose. And this debuted at December 9, 1977 at the Coker Gallery in New York, which was incidentally owned by Fred Woolworth of the Five and Dime chain, who happened to own the Detroit Tigers during the late 50s. Tom Seaver and the other athletes that opened up a new world for Andy Warhol. In his 1975 book, The Philosophy of Andy Warhol, he noted, all the new movie stars are the sports people. They're the really good-looking people and the exciting people, and they make the most money. And this is interesting because Andy Warhol realizes that important to him is two reasons. One is, as subjects, they're people for him to paint, but they're also kind of like customers. They're people that might be interested in his paintings, and that's something that he realized doing the athlete series. Thank you. I just want to acknowledge a couple of people. Everybody that I talked to with the museum, they were great. I got the chance to exchange emails with Carl Solway. Tom Seaver, I think I saw him come in here. He answered quite a few questions, and he wrote a great article on the Tom Seaver painting. And Grace, can you stand up? This is Grace Marston from the Andy Warhol Museum. Grace answered a number of questions for me, and come up here and probably handle some questions that are art questions because I probably can't handle them. Finally, if you want to see the baseball main, which is called Baseball, not Roger Maris, that's in the Nelson Atkins Gallery in Kansas City. Pete Rose remains in Cincinnati. Tom Seaver, since there's like 8 of them, can be seen in a number of places. One is in Cooperstown. They have one over here at the Andy Warhol Museum, but the stencil's on display now.
It's the test print.
Test prints on there.
Yeah, so just black and white.
And if for all you people that are friends with Tom Seaver, Tom has one over the entryway of his home. I thank you for your attention, and we're ready for some questions.
It's close to the ballpark.
Yeah, that's right. It's just a block away from PNC Park. It's across the 7th Street Bridge, which is also called the Andy Warhol Bridge. So we're open 10 to 5 almost every day. We're closed Mondays. Today, because it's Friday, we're open late, actually. Every Friday, we're open till 10 p.m., and we're half price after 5 o'clock. So that's a good time to stop by.
Great gift store.
That's true. Yeah, good gift store as well. The lobby.
I have a question for you. On the Rose card, on the Rose of painting, it has that Cincinnati Reds logo that always has the trademark next to it. Mm-hmm. Did Warhol have to get permission to use that?
Yeah, I probably should have asked Carl Solway that question. I did not. I know Andy Warhol got sued in the 60s over infringement of photos, so I think he would have been careful about that, but I do not know that information.
Yeah, so in the 60s, he was appropriating all sorts of logos that didn't belong to him, but it was sort of unprecedented at the time where these corporations weren't sure what to do, and so he experienced relatively few lawsuits over the course of his career just because no one was really sure how to approach him about it. But by the 80s, you know, he had gone through a few like legal headaches, and so he was being a lot more careful by this point and going through more of the proper channels. And so the fact that, you know, he insisted on getting Pete Rose's permission, you know, for instance, is important because in the early 60s he wasn't getting Elvis Presley or Elizabeth Taylor's permission to do their portrait. Yeah.
On the Seaver, he obliterated the Rawlings logo.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
On any of these works of art, did Warhol ever do any brush strokes in any way?
Yeah, so for Tom Seaver, he's painting the background colors by hand. So that's how you can see all those kind of striations. You know, he is doing that by hand, and then he's just silkscreen printing the photograph on top in black on top of all the background colors. Yes.
Andy Warhol certainly got a lot of attention. He's used to having his stuff shown. How do you think he'd react from the both of you? How he would react being a presentation at a Saber meeting?
I bet he would have said what he almost always said was, "Oh, gee, that's great." yeah, he always liked attention, but it's true. I mean, he was very prolific, and he took on so many different subject matters. So there's, you know, sports, architecture, you know, politics and history, and so he ended up in a lot of kind of oddly specific situations like this over the course of his lifetime. Yeah.
All true. That's true.
Okay.
Well, we've got 2.5 minutes to fill here.
I visited the museum the other day and I loved it. There was also a piece called The Baseball Players, 1950. Is that anything that you studied as well? Is there any more information about where that
really,
who posed for that or whatever? Thank you.
So that's a rather obscure piece. There's a lot less information about his work from the 1950s because that is before he became famous. He wasn't documenting himself quite as thoroughly. He got rid of a lot of things from that period. But we believe that that drawing is actually some commissioned work for Sports Illustrated magazine. So in the 1950s, before Warhol was a famous pop artist, he was doing commercial art and advertising illustrations. And so he actually did do like advertisements for Sports Illustrated during that period.
So, Paul, this question is directed to you. We both know that Seaver was intimate and commented on his own painting, as did Rose and Warhol. But did Maris ever, in your research, did you discover any Maris comments about that?
Yeah, as far as I know, no, he did not. The one thing is, I talked to Bart Maris, which is, I believe, his nephew, and I just asked him, and he didn't really think he did. However, the painting does hang in Kansas City, and of course, you know, Roger Maris lived there during the off seasons, you know, when he was a Yankee, because he preferred that area, and he went to the Cardinals, so he was a native of that area. So it's very well that he could have been there. That painting has hung there since 1962, which might be the longest that any of his paintings have hung in a single museum.
Yeah, the fact that they got in early is pretty significant, yeah, and that it hasn't changed hands.
One more quick question.
I know that Warhol just liked to collect a lot of
just stuff and objects and things. While going through his boxes and his archives, were there just any surprising sports items?
Yeah, we've got all sorts of wacky things in there. So there are a couple baseball cards in the collection. One was a gift from another artist named Ray Johnson. And then we do have a Yankees cap that was signed by Bobby Mercer, that Bobby Mercer gave to him in the early 1980s. Yeah, but there's also, you know, there's boxing gloves. Oh, Pete Rose did sign a baseball for Andy that we have in the collection. But yeah, there's all sorts of wacky things in those time capsules.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.